And a very good morning to you. We are live in London and you are with Monocle on Sunday with me, Emma Nelson. Coming up on today's programme here at Midori House, my guests Terry Stiasny and Stephen Diel share their views on the week's biggest story. Terry, good morning. What have you spotted?
Good morning. Well, I'm interested in all the tensions and what's been going on behind the scenes of the so-called Weimar Triangle. We've been getting lots of insights into European diplomacy. And I'm also fascinated by whether footballers are going to be dressing as cartoon characters this summer.
Aren't we all? Thank you for that. Stephen, how are you doing?
I'm very well. The biggest story of today is also in some ways the biggest non-story, I would suggest, because it's the Russian election, which is not really an election because everyone knows that Putin is going to win.
Thank you very much for that. We also head to Nairobi for the latest headlines.
This is Monocle's correspondent in Nairobi, and I will be looking at how the last-minute release of two opposition leaders in Senegal could change the outcome of the upcoming election, and why Tanzania is the happiest country in Africa.
We'll also have a check-in with our editorial director, Tyler Brulé, who'll be joining me on the line from Lisbon. It's the 17th of March, 2024. Live from London, this is Monocle on Sunday.
Live from London, this is Monocle on Sunday with Emma Nelson.
So we have a busy and crisp and fun hour of radio to look forward to for the next 60 minutes. A very good morning to you, Terry Stiasny and Stephen Diel.
Good morning. Good morning.
We shall be briefly, well, in a moment, talking about picking up skiing at 47, Stephen, fresh off the plane from Andorra, where he's been running some black runs, everybody. So we'll be looking at that. But let's head somewhere warmer first. Let's head to Lisbon, where we can join our Monocle's editorial director, Tyler Brulé. A very good morning to you. Bom dia.
Bom dia. Good morning, Emma.
I am assuming you are not looking at a black run this morning, but you're looking at something slightly bluer, greener and warmer.
Yeah, indeed. In fact, I'm actually south of Lisbon, about 90 minutes south in Melilla. So Alentejo, but on the coast. I think, of course, if people aren't familiar with Melilla as a small town, then people will be familiar with Comporta. So just, I guess, sort of a little bit up the hill from the coast at a wonderful project that we covered last year called Pateos. That's a P-A. Full stop, T-E, full stop, O-S. I'm not sure why. It must have been some copyright concept that they had to name it such. But an absolutely extraordinary little project, which is, yeah, just nestled in these wonderful hills. And it really is that start of spring feeling. Everything is in bloom here. Absolutely delightful. A bit of a hazy but nevertheless sunny sky this morning. A delight as we certainly head to the end of March.
Indeed, and Pateos is an incredibly relaxing place, and not just on its location, but in sort of like the tone and the spirit that they've set there.
Indeed, it's a series of villas, just four very large villas, designed by the architect firm Mateus Aris. So very just raw concrete. It very much reminds you of the work of. Certainly it feels very sort of Tadoando. It feels very Japanese. But, of course, this is also their vernacular as well. I'm thinking if you look back to, you know, certainly mid-century Portuguese architecture, there is this sense of the raw and the reduced. And this has really just been sort of carved out of the countryside. And it's one of those things, of course, you can see it on page and you can see it on screen. And then you drive up and experience it. And I have to say, I mean, it's not for the faint-hearted. You take the sort of 2.5 kilometer track to get to this off of, you know, what is, well, you could barely call it a main road. You really have to have, I would say, not a low slung, but a highly slung vehicle because there's been a lot of rain of late as well. So these roads feel much more Namibia than they probably do the outback of Portugal.
Okay. I sense a bit of a heart melting moment for Portugal here, but you wrote in your column this morning, I think we can play a little bit of a game about which is better, Athens or Lisbon. This is one of the nicest problems a human could face.
Indeed, and we've covered this territory probably lightly before, which is, of course, the great competition, the great relocation that we've seen of certainly many people out of the UK who want to have maybe a sunnier base certainly in the EU. And then, of course, I don't really want to use the word digital nomads, but I'll use it for Sunday morning shorthand. But people who have been who have the ability to really work, you know, from you know, pretty much anywhere. And there has been this sort of, I would say, light competition for the extreme ends of the EU, Lisbon on one side. And of course, we've had this moment of the golden visas and certainly Portugal has worked very hard at also attracting wealth and investment through a fast-track residency system. And likewise, we've seen the rise of, and really a turnaround, which is occurring in Greece, but particularly in Athens, where here you have a city as well, which of course is looking for a new level of investment. It's you know, off the back of the crisis in Lebanon, has enjoyed an enormous influx of wealth from Lebanon as well. So, and then, of course, you know, there's all of the improvements that come with it for a city, and that's what you're experiencing on both sides. As I said last week, we did a fantastic event in Athens for the magazine, met all of our Athenian readership and people who came from slightly further afield in Greece, and we were here for a small corporate summit in Lisbon at the back end of the week as well. And I have to say, the city sort of, you know, put on a fantastic show on both sides. Athens was definitely a surprise last week. And as I wrote in my column today, I sort of think that Lisbon must have been reading the column because it thought, you know, we feel a little bit put out by this Athens place. So let's see if we can lay on a particularly good show for Monocle's editors. And it did.
Okay, well, let's play the game then. So should we judge Athens and Lisbon on, what, two or three things? Let's talk about logistics and geography first. Logistics, which is easiest to get to?
Well, that well depends, of course, where you live.
Exactly.
But of course, you could. So listen, I mean, for our listeners waking up in North America, Lisbon is a very, you know, quick hop across the Atlantic. And if the winds are in your favor, you can be here rather quickly. Now, let's say get to the core of landing in a city. Lisbon is, I feel it's like it's a little bit like the new Hong Kong in many ways, because it's one of the last airports where you are a landing on, you know, in your A320 or whatever it is, and you're almost between sort of the laundry flapping in some of these towers, which are of course on the approach to the airport. And when you get, you know, off the aircraft, then it's, you know, it's incredibly quick. I mean, you can be in town in 10-12 minutes, which is remarkable. So I would say logistics wise, you know, and if I think about, again, our core audience, you know, our biggest markets are the UK, our biggest markets are the US, then I would say that probably Lisbon wins on that one.
Okay, so 1-0 to Lisbon. Let's talk about the city itself, livability, walkability, eatability, if that's a word. Which one's winning on that one? That's a tough one, I'd say.
That is a tough one. I mean, I don't want to give it up to a tie. There's something about, I just love the scale of Athens. And of course, I love all of the, you know, there was just, of course, a lot of fantastic architecture that went up in the 1960s and 70s. There's some absolute shockers as well. But there's this density about that you get in Athens, which is amazing. And the street markets and just the balconies and all of the greenery spilling over. And Athens also hilly, as is Lisbon, but I would say it is a real tough one, because there are other things that, where I would say also, you know, Lisbon is in some ways is much more walkable, and let's say in the new sense of walkable, are the pavements maybe a little bit more level. They're certainly more beautiful, the pavements, because you've got all of the extraordinary stonework, you know, all of the wonderful sort of wavy designs on the streets of Athens. I mean, on the streets of Lisbon, I should say. I'm going to have to say it's a tie. So is that 2-1 now, I guess?
I'm going to push for Athens on that one, because I can never get over the fact, you know, when you go up a hill and you just look and Athens goes on forever. You've no idea where it ends or begins at that sort of sea of beautiful white. But at the same time, you can be at the bottom of the Parthenon and turn round and see an amazing mid-century building with a beautiful orange overhang and a balcony on it. And you think, well, I could live there. This is not a problem. I could live here immediately. Finally, people. Now, this is a toughie, because they both have that real sense of resilience to them, don't they? They can get themselves out of economic and all kinds of scrapes really quickly. And their food is amazing and their welcome is amazing. So are we on to another tie again, Tyler?
Yeah, this is a really tricky one. I think that the Portuguese are a little bit, the Lisboans are a bit more reserved. They don't sort of present themselves with quite the sort of the exuberance and joy that the Athenians do. But, you know, again, if we're sort of playing a long game, that is a really, really tricky one, because I was also really, you know, positively surprised by just, you know, not just the warm welcome, but just also the sense of follow-up. And we just made so many great connections in Athens last week. So I have to say that it is a tricky one. Listen, what we can say, Emma, it's going to require more research, more time spent in both cities, at least, well, not just over the course of the summer, over the years to come, you could say. But I think you go back to this point about, you know, when that's just the great thing when you're out in the world and it is that moment of sort of looking up, looking around and thinking, could I live in this place? And I think both of those, both cities answer that very well. And also, I guess the other thing we're sort of talking about for, you know, our listeners, certainly in the northern reaches of the northern hemisphere, you know, both are cities as well, which, you know, really start to already come into their own with springtime in late February already. So, and that is where there's a real duel. I mean, you can look in, on various websites, and both Athens and Lisbon make claims to being the sunniest cities in the EU.
Malta. Now,
well, let's leave out Malta. No, actually, Valletta's going to get upset. Valletta also has claims on that one. Different scale.
So it all has to come down to who has the best military uniform. The Portuguese have really good naval uniforms.
They do, absolutely. And as I dropped the note, I said one of the interesting stories as we shift this program to talk about geopolitics and certainly what's happening in Europe, really interesting story which popped up, which we actually covered, I think, the week before last, which is teeny tiny Portugal, of course, extraordinary naval history, is building something that, if we had to present the image to your son, Emma, we'd say, what kind of vessel is this? And I think, you know, definitely he would say, that's an aircraft carrier, Mom. This is a very particular club of nations around the world that can boast having aircraft carriers. Portugal is building something which, you know, very much looks like an aircraft carrier. They're doing it with recovery funds from the EU. It's a joint Dutch and Portuguese venture. And, of course, this is part of the great rearming of nations everywhere. But, you know, if you would have asked me, you know, even 3 years ago, would a nation like Portugal feel that they need to have an aircraft carrier? Probably not.
Let's touch on the new edition of Monocle magazine. It's nearly ready. It's on its way. What have we got to look forward to?
Well, of course, this is our April issue. It is the season, of course, of new collections, talking new collections on the fashion side coming out. It is our big style and fashion number. Also mixed with hospitality, though, as well, because part of a good welcome, as I think many of us would agree, is also you're being greeted by well-turned-out staff as well. So part of the issue is also just, and that's what the cover focuses on, it just looks at the properties around the world where there's really an investment and also a focus on putting people in fantastic uniforms, because we know that there's also, you know, many businesses think, oh, well, you know what, we might as well just make it a bit of a free-for-all. It's okay if actually, you know, the staff look like the guests, and maybe it's actually at the cost savings anyway, let people wear whatever they want. And you know, this, of course, causes myriad problems, because, of course, you can't tell who's going to go and deal with your check-in details as much as, you know, who might help with the luggage or who's going to bring you your breakfast. So we spend a little bit of time dissecting that topic. But also, this is at a time when we know that the service industry is in crisis in so many corners of the world. How do you give people a sense of pride? You know, how do you make them, you know, feel like, yes, as a business, we've put people and we've invested and we've worked with good designers. So people also feel and look their best when they're out delivering, you know, hopefully what is an outstanding service.
Tyler, thank you so much for your time and wishing you the best of weekends in Lisbon. That was our editorial director, Tyler Brulé, on the line from Portugal from there. You've just enjoyed some Andorran hospitality, Stephen DL. What's that like? I mean, Tyler was making a really good point there, that when you go into a place and you're not sure who does what because they're all wearing their own clothes, maybe there's an iPad. That's not always brilliant. What are they like in Andorra? Is there tradition? Is there a sort of real sense of duty and what have you?
apparently, talking to some local people, and they're quite difficult to find in the hospitality area. I'll come back to that. But apparently, Andorra's going through big changes at the moment. It had a reputation, and before the crash of 2008, that most people had a very high standard of living. But the crash hit it badly. Of course, it's a very small country. It could fit, Andorra could fit three times into London. That's how small Andorra is. But as I say, in the hospitality area, I got talking to a number of people on the management of the slopes, and it turns out that the vast majority seem to be from South America, because they can come and work in Andorra, where, of course, there are Catalan is the official language, but everyone also speaks Spanish and French. So there's not a language problem, and they don't need a visa to come from Argentina in particular, it seems. Argentina, Colombia, Peru. And so they could come. I'm not talking a lot about locals. The locals I did speak to were very pleasant, but certainly on the slopes, A, the staff were fantastic. B, the organisation was really good. And very importantly, if you're skiing, of course, the snow apparently was the best it's been all winter, even though we're well into March.
I was about to say, possibly the only place in the world where the snow's been all right.
could well be, but it was certainly the week just gone was definitely the week to be skiing in Andorra.
I haven't asked you yet if you've ever been skiing in Andorra, Terry.
I haven't been to Andorra, but picking up on, so the most recent place I've been to get away from the rain in London, which has just not stopped at all, was Miami. And interestingly, all the waiting staff and people, most of the people in hospitality in Miami were also Argentinian, or at least the ones we talked to. And my kids could get on with them because they all had sort of talking about Messi, who was playing football in Miami, and how much they love Messi. And so, you know, conversations about Messi. But yeah, really large numbers of South Americans, which obviously has long been the case in Miami, but, you know, seem to be a new generation coming from different places.
And the general warmth and you know, liveliness that you get from South American hospitality. I mean, you'd hate to sort of make massive generalizations, but there is a sort of, there's a vibrancy to it, which you don't necessarily get, as I didn't yesterday on a trip to Brighton. Yeah, I'm not quite sure Athens, Lisbon and Brighton are coming up on an equal match at the moment. But you know, as I waited 15 minutes for my fish and chips, you know, prior the seagull attack on the beach, I did sort of slightly wonder where we went wrong a little bit, and when people actually stopped cared about looking after each other in terms of hospitality, when it actually stopped being something that people wanted to do because they believed in sort of a few underpinning values, which is service, being and ultimately being nice to people and welcoming people.
Well, I would immediately leap on the and bash down again at Brexit for this, because before 2016, we haven't had a lot of very pleasant foreigners who had worked in hospitality in this country. And the feeling was that a lot of Brits didn't want to. And of course, we're not as welcoming to the foreigners, which is terrible. and so, yeah, hospitality and general service in this country now, I think, is pretty appalling.
Chips were good, though. Right, let's. It's 18 minutes past nine here in London. Let's have a look at some of the papers. And the news that, as you said at the beginning of the story, Stephen, beginning of the hour, I should say, Stephen, was that this is the world's biggest story, which isn't a story, namely the Russian elections. President Putin will win another term. He will be in power until 2030, at least, making his tenure longer than that of Stalin. And yet the headlines today is of a spirit of protest that critics of the Kremlin have told people to go to polling stations silently and either spoil their ballot paper or do something or just be there.
And, of course, the elections actually started on Friday. Today is the official polling day, Sunday the 17th of March. But people could start voting on Friday. We've just passed a crucial moment, and because it's literally just passed 19 minutes ago, I don't know how big the demonstration has been, but before he died, Alexei Navalny, the day before he died, called for people to go along on this day, Sunday the 17th, at midday to their local polling station and vote for him or cause some sort of protest and turn up in mass numbers. And since his tragic death, his wife, Yulia, has picked up on that as well. There was a very, very interesting article in the Washington Post this week by Yulia Navalnaya and repeating that call. So we're too close to it. It's literally just a few minutes ago. So by this evening, we'll know whether people picked up on that. But in the meantime, anyway, people have been going along and pouring a green iodine solution into ballot boxes. That's particularly significant because it's something that Russians and Soviet citizens for years would use on cuts and abrasions as an antiseptic. But it's also very significant because it was thrown over Navalny a few years ago. He was attacked, nearly sent him blind, in fact. So that's very significant. It's not just something people have picked up. They're referring back to this attack on Navalny. There have been a couple of cases of polling stations being set on fire, ballot boxes being set on fire. People are showing some signs of protest. Now, of course, news is always what is the unusual, really. We shouldn't get this out of context, and the majority of places have not had fires or iodine thrown over them. But the fact that people are prepared to do this, it shows also, if we go back a couple of weeks to Navalny's funeral and the number of people who for days afterwards were going and making a mountain of flowers on his grave, that there are Russians still in Russia who don't like what's going on, who are not voting for Putin today. The result, as you say, is a foregone conclusion. I mean, there used to be a Soviet joke that 2 months before the election, someone broke into the Kremlin and stole the election results. They could have done that in modern Russia, sadly. All of Putin's real opponents have been either murdered, jailed, or in exile. So there are three other names on the ballot. I'm not even going to mention them because they're so insignificant. They all support Putin, basically.
There's an interesting thing that actually just while you were talking there, Stephen, I started to look online to see what this Noon Against Putin demonstration is looking like. And quite astonishing, Terry, there are queues. There are hundreds, thousands of people just calmly, simply queuing. And I was quite baffled and quite struck by the fact that something as innocuous as a queue has become a risky protest.
Yes, I think that's really interesting. And I think, you know, we need to think about how brave you have to be even just to go out and, as you say, go and queue, go and protest, go and demonstrate, let alone to spoil your ballot paper or to pour, you know, liquids into ballot boxes, because you can't imagine that people are not being watched, they are not being followed, and there might be some repercussions for them down the line. And of course, you know, we're probably never going to know, you know, exactly. They're not going to say there were this many spoilt ballot papers or this many spoilt ballot boxes. We're not going to get that as a figure coming from the Kremlin. So it's hard to evaluate. But it's also interesting how people are able to access, you know, the internet and other media to try and put this view across and to try and show us the pictures and to show us what people are doing in order to register that protest. And of course, again, looking, you know, the Russian government, Medvedev's saying they're accusing Ukraine of doing this. They're saying it's terrorist activities. They're calling people traitors. And, you know, all the full weight of the state is likely to be exerted against people.
I wonder also, the thing that I think many people will miss about Navalny is the good spirit and the humour and the human aspect of protest. The fact that he, before he died, suggested that people just go and queue outside a station is the most innocent but devastating thing to do. And when you lack that sense of humour, which is what totally drove him in terms of his communication technique, it will get very, very dark, won't it?
It already has. And of course, Putin has no sense of humour. I mean, you know, if there's a more humourless person in the world, I don't know who they are. But you're absolutely right. But also, as Terry was just suggesting, I don't have a computer in front of me, I'm afraid, so I hadn't seen what the initial result reaction was going to be. But if they are queuing in their thousands, what it shows also is that despite the Russian state's efforts in recent years to clamp down on the internet as much as possible, creating their own domain and hopefully having everyone only looking at a Kremlin-approved sites and so on, and I saw one report this week saying that they're closing down something like 800 websites a day in Russia to stop people finding out other information. But of course, particularly the young who are tech savvy have got VPNs so they can pretend that they're not in Russia and can read a lot more. But that shows if thousands are getting out, and if, for example, Yulia Navalny's article in the Washington Post has been read by thousands of people across Russia, then this suggests that more people than the Kremlin would like to know are actually getting access to Western information.
Let's talk a little bit about the rest of the world's reaction to what is going on here. I mean, obviously, we stand powerless to stop what is going on in Russia in terms of the democratic process and its erosion. But you do have Western leaders still just clashing and crashing and banging into each other about how to deal with Ukraine. And it just seems to be a perpetually destabilised issue, which is obviously something which the Kremlin will enjoy.
Yeah, one of the things I thought was really interesting this week, I mean, obviously we've had the so-called Weimar Triangle meeting with Germany, Poland and France, but it's quite interesting how much France, Emmanuel Macron in particular, is pushing a massive sort of PR effort, I think you can call it, on Ukraine. I mean, he's done lots of interviews. He's done an interview with Le Parisien on his plane back from Berlin. He did a big sit-down interview with French TV this week, in which he was really trying to persuade France that this situation in Ukraine is a massive issue of security for the whole of Europe. And there was one line he said, you know, it's only 1,500 kilometres from Strasbourg to Lviv. And, you know, this affects all of us. You know, we can't rule out having French troops potentially on the ground, that this is a, you know, real existential issue. And really interestingly, if you can find it, I recommend there's a clip of a French TV documentary which followed Macron during, do you remember, before the invasion, all these controversial phone calls that Macron had with President Putin and people saying, well, are you being too soft on him? He had TV cameras in there. And what you saw is Macron actually sort of fact-checking and challenging Putin, but he had a whole team of French diplomats sitting in another room. So Macron would be on the sort of the landline on the speakerphone with Putin. He had his mobile there, and the diplomats in the next room were going, that's not true, pick him up on that. That's not, you know, don't tell him that. And that he is sort of challenging, you know, what Vladimir Putin is saying. And so this is obviously part of, you know, I was not being weak on him. I was telling him what was what. And it's a really, really interesting insight into how modern diplomacy is conducted with all of the team there going and sort of doing real-time fact-checking on a phone call.
It's absolutely well worth a watch because it reminds me slightly of how the Newsnight team used to work at the BBC, that you'd have a politician sitting, being interviewed, and the questions would come and there would be a bevy of people in the background going, that's wrong, pick him up on that, pick her up on that.
Yeah, exactly.
How much does Putin enjoy being given history lessons by French president?
He certainly doesn't like. He doesn't like being given history lessons by anyone. He thinks he knows the history of Russia and the history of the world. It's a very warped history. For example, there was a clip some months ago of him with one of his ministers looking at a map from the 18th century and Putin going, well, there you are, you see, there's no such country as Ukraine, as we've said all along, which just shows such an ignorance of European history, the way borders have changed. And Ukraine did exist. That's why in 1654, Ukraine signed an agreement with Russia. Rather like in 1707, England signed an agreement with Scotland.
And actually, we're bringing, I think context and history is becoming increasingly important. I mean, you mentioned there the Weimar Triangle. I will absolutely hold my hands up to this one until it happened. There was a revival of it this week with the meetings of the French president, the German chancellor and the Polish prime minister. I had to look up what the Weimar Triangle was. For those of us who are sitting there thinking, I really don't want to say that I don't know what it is. Could you possibly explain to us what it is, please?
Well, this was a sort of a grouping set up between, as you say, France, Germany and Poland in the beginning of the 90s when it was a transition, you know, before Poland was in the EU or NATO, to try and, you know, bring Poland, I suppose, into the European family. But interestingly, what you've got now is Poland, who is obviously under its new government under Donald Tusk, who's, you know, very concerned about what's going on in Ukraine, pushing sort of the rest of Europe to try to go further. And then you've got a very reluctant Germany that is being sort of reluctantly shoved into trying to do more with Olaf Scholz, you know, constantly. There does seem to be quite a lot of tension between these leaders as to, you know, what the direction is. But it's just, you know, a reminder of how much things have changed, I suppose, in the last 30 years or so, you know, in different directions, in different parts of Central and Eastern Europe.
And isn't it funny how a mere matter of months ago, pre-October, Poland was ostracised from the European Union. It had human rights issues. It was, you know, the rule of law, all that kind of stuff was an enormous headache for the European Union. And yet now we see the Polish Prime Minister not least because of his European background, but also because of Poland's astonishing role in current politics and in current conflict, possibly being the man that can bring these two fighting parties together. And you suddenly think, actually, Poland, its size, its relevance, its geography must never be underestimated in Europe.
Yeah, I was in Warsaw in September and talking to someone who there was a lot of tension about, you know, which way will the elections go, and the more liberal-minded, shall we say, Poles were very worried that people were thinking, you know, well, what's happened? You know, people in the rest of Europe were thinking, well, what, you know, what's happened in Poland? What's become of it? And they were hoping and praying that they would get the right result, which they did, which is very good news, because it's always struck me as baffling that, because I do go back that far and the collapse of communism in Europe and so on, having followed it and reported on it very closely, that the two most forward-thinking Eastern European countries, as we thought of them then, were Poland and Hungary. And yet, until October last year, the two that worried us most were Poland and Hungary. Hungary, of course, still does. And I will reserve my comments on the Hungarian leader, Mr. Orban, who's a big friend of Putin, which is not good news. But it's very, very good news that Poland now seems to be showing the way. Although, interestingly, of course, what we've also had in Poland recently is a lot of demonstrations by farmers against Ukraine. But there is strong feeling that these actually are Russian-sponsored in many ways, these demonstrations. There is certainly Russian influence behind them.
You're listening to Monocle on Sunday with me, Emma Nelson. Joining me in the studio, Stephen Diel and Terry Stiasny. The time here in London is 9:31. Let's head to Nairobi. Naveena Kotar is our correspondent there and is there to bring us the latest from where she is. A very good, warm welcome to Monocle on Sunday, Naveena.
Good morning, Emma.
How's Nairobi looking this morning or afternoon?
It's very sunny. There are lots of birds in my garden. It's a very beautiful day. We are still in the warm season here, so it's a very nice place to be in March, actually.
Okay, thanks for that. We're not feeling remotely miserable as a result, but there we are. We're very glad. Actually, what's quite nice is every time I do talk to you, Naveena, there is always some warmth, some sunshine and some birds chirping in the background.
Yes.
So you're taking us to somewhere absolutely needed.
Let's wait to April.
Yeah, just wait. Does it all go wrong then?
Yes, that's when the rainy season is supposed to start.
Okay,
see.
We'll ring you then and then we'll gloat. Okay, tell us what's happening, what stories you've picked up today that you think we need to know about.
Yes, I think the most interesting development is really in Senegal, where on Thursday, two top opposition leaders were released from prison. One of them, Bassirou Diomaye Faye, will run as a presidential candidate in the election that's happening next Sunday, in a week's time. He's being supported by the really popular opposition leader, Ousmane Sonko, who has been serving prison sentences, and he can't run for office because of several legal challenges. But he is supporting Faye. And when they were released on Thursday, there were lots of people greeting and celebrating the release on Thursday. There was a public address on Friday, and it really looks like this team now has a chance of securing the presidency. I think we have to wait and see how the remaining week that they have to campaign pans out. But I think it's quite an interesting turn in a country that has seen lots of protest against the established government, against the sitting president, Macky Sall, who's not going to run again. And I think there's a real chance of this established party being thrown out of office next week.
Can I just explain to us a little bit of the context? Macky Sall delayed the elections, didn't he, about a month ago?
Yes.
What effect has that had on Senegal?
Yes, he delayed the election. He has also, it took him a long time to rule out that he was not going to run for a third term in office. There have been protests in the country over the last 12 months against Macky Sall, against Ousmane Sonko having to go to prison or having to face legal challenges. The decision to delay the election really resulted in more protests, in a curfew. I think there was a lot of diplomatic pressure on Macky Sall to not delay this election any further. So then he called it again, and his former Prime Minister Amadou Ba is basically running for the government. But it was really an attempt, this finally having this election, to calm down the situation in a country where these kind of protests have actually been quite rare.
Let's move on to a story which has dominated the international headlines this week, which is namely what's been happening in Haiti.
Yes, exactly. I mean, we've talked about this on the program. There seemed to be a decision, a legal decision and an agreement to send about 1,000 Kenyan police officers to Haiti to help calm the situation there. The president, William Ruto, signed an agreement with the interim prime minister, Henri, here in the capital. We talked about this about 2 weeks ago. And last week, the prime minister resigned, and that prompted the Kenyan government to basically put this plan to deploy the police officers on hold. There is a lot of skepticism anyway as to whether this plan to send police officers to Haiti, where gangs are basically ruling the capital and large parts of the country, can actually make a difference. The United States, as well as Canada, have really been looking for countries to commit police officers to this mission, but it's entirely unclear what the mandate is. There are questions here as to why Kenyan police officers are sent. They don't have the language skills. So I think for now, we just need to wait and see what happens in Haiti, whether they will be able to form a credible government that has the right to ask for this kind of help. But for now, the Kenyan police officers aren't going anywhere.
Indeed. And in the absence of a deployment, this has become a domestic problem in Kenya, hasn't it? Because I think the country's most senior court in January ruled the deployment of Kenyan officers to Haiti as unconstitutional. So this has become a huge domestic issue.
Yes, the opposition did take this to court, and the court ruled that it required a slightly different legal framework in order for Kenyan police officers to be deployed outside the country. This agreement that was then signed between the then Haitian Prime Minister and President Ruto 2 weeks ago was meant to basically help with this legal situation, establish a framework that would allow this kind of deployment. But I think there are now more doubts in the Kenyan government whether, in the absence of an elected government, is actually such a good idea to send the police officers to Haiti.
Let's talk about that marvellous overlap of politics and sport, which we're going to talk about. I mean, I know that Terry, a little bit later on the programme, wants to dress up the European footballers in strange costumes. We'll get to that in a moment. But on a more sort of slightly serious level, we have a battle between Rwanda and Burundi, which has basically manifested itself in an argument in basketball.
Yes, in the Basketball Africa League. It's the NBA's only professional league outside the United States. Burundi's Dynamo Basketball Club has withdrawn from the league because it would have had... Basically, the league is being sponsored by the Rwandan government's tourism branch, Visit Rwanda. That means that all the jerseys have to be branded with Visit Rwanda, and the team had refused to comply with these rules. It did so two or three times, and that meant that its season basically ended this week. I think it's important to explain that in January, the border between Burundi and Rwanda was closed after Burundi's president accused Rwanda of backing a rebel militia and claimed that it's something that the Rwandan government has denied, but it has led to quite a lot of diplomatic tension. And the reporting suggests that this decision not to wear the logo was coming from the Burundi government.
And finally, let's talk about neighbours. Tanzania. If you're feeling down in Kenya, in theory, all you do is you hop over the border and you cheer up enormously. Why would I be making that suggestion?
Yes, it's quite an interesting study that has been conducted by the Global Mind Project. It's a global study looking at the state of mental health after COVID and the lockdowns we've all experienced. And it found that Tanzania is Africa's happiest country and that Tanzania is also the third happiest country in the world. I think if you look at the details, you'll see that actually this study that you might think is a bit silly actually looks at why people are more resilient, have better mental health records around the world. And they found a close connection between smartphone ownership and the consumption of ultra-processed food and mental health challenges. And what they're saying is that in wealthier countries, the age of first smartphone ownership is much younger. Ultra-processed food consumption is much higher. That might also explain why, for example, the UK is at the very bottom of this list. And in other countries, like in Tanzania, there are less smartphones, there's less ultra-processed food. So the survey is actually quite interesting. It found that not just Tanzania, but also Mozambique, Cote d'Ivoire, Cameroon, Tunisia, and Angola rank quite high. And South Africa was in Africa the unhappiest country on the continent.
This is astonishing because obviously many people would see that access to smartphone ownership and being able to buy a burger are quite essential to sort of the success of any given society.
Yes, exactly. I think this study does follow WHO categories, and it looked at factors like resilience, and it ranks it quite in quite a lot of detail. So it found that adaptability and resilience in Tanzania were much higher than in other countries, and it's able to draw a connection to these factors that I've mentioned. Also found that, for example, that factors like drive and motivation were higher. So I think it's worth looking at this globally, because the findings are really, really surprising. The top three countries are the Dominican Republic, Sri Lanka, and Tanzania. And at the bottom, we find South Africa, the United Kingdom, and Uzbekistan.
Goodness me. Right. Okay. Yeah. Thank you. Naveena Kotter in Nairobi. How happy is Nairobi? Quick question.
Nairobi, I think, is somewhere in the middle. It's kind of in the bottom third of the survey.
Actually, stay with
just
us.
Just under Portugal and ahead of the United States.
Yeah, everything's... Right, OK, let's bring the guests into this one. Naveena, stay with us on this one. We were going to say goodbye to you, but what you've just said has actually made Stephen put his head in his hands. Uzbekistan, United Kingdom, and which was the worst? Which, above the UK, Naveena? Which one?
Let me have a look.
While you're looking...
South Africa.
South Africa, right. OK, your reactions to that, lovely people in the studio.
It doesn't surprise me, to be honest. I'd hate to sound... I'm generally a very optimistic person, but I do find the disunited kingdom, I think I should say, as a Scot as well. I do find it depressing these days that, you know, we have the worst government, literally the worst government I have known in my long life. Where I live in London, we have a terrible council which makes decisions which completely ignore the residents. I've long been saying the only thing you can really get right in this country is make sure your own little family life and your friends are welcome, and then that's your own little nest. That's all you can do, because otherwise things are pretty bleak.
Terry, can you improve upon that?
I think on a rainy Sunday morning in March in London, when the tubes aren't running properly, you know, there is this sense, and it's little things like that when you're sort of sitting looking at the rainy window of a bus, and you just... But I think there's a general sense of things not working in the country at the moment in the way they are supposed to, whether that is, you know, the train system, whether that is the, you know, the transport more generally, you know, politics. There is this kind of a sense that things need fixing and they are not at the moment being fixed. And I think, you know, we're obviously expecting an election later on in the year, and we will see how that all plays out. But there is, yeah, a slight sense of, you know, it's just not quite, you know, it's not right, it's not working properly.
Naveena, we're sitting in Nairobi when you're listening to two miserable people in London. Does that, not miserable, but people with a rather gloomier view of London, as many think, does that surprise you how down the Brits might be getting about their state of life?
in March or February, probably not. Let's see how everyone feels in June or July. But I think it's important to stress we're talking about mental well-being, and they looked at different factors. They've surveyed, I think, 7,000 people around the world. So we do need to take these studies with a pinch of salt. But I think it is, to a certain extent, not that surprising that, you know, sitting inside, not being outside, not being around, surrounded by nature, but also maybe not having that much time to spend on your mobile phone might make you feel better or not that great.
Navina, you have just brought a beautiful ray of sunshine to Monocle on Sunday. Thank you so much for joining us on the line from Nairobi. You're listening to Monocle on Sunday. Tickets to Dar es Salaam, anyone?
Yep. Or Athens or Lisbon or, you know.
Let's talk about a few more stories that we've picked up in the papers. Terry, we mentioned a moment, the Belgian football team addressing as Tintin for the Euros. This is this idea of soft power and whatever it is that sport, the magic that sport sprinkles upon the rest of life, and how you get the rest of life to actually have any influence on sport.
I think, yes, talking about sort of national moods, I mean, one of the things that does affect a national mood is tends to be, you know, how well your country is doing in competitions. And I think, you know, there's a sense in Britain that, well, you know, if one of the teams does well in the Euros, in the football, things might cheer up, or the Olympics, people might cheer up a bit, you know, remains to be seen. But I love this story because it is how Belgium, the Belgian football team in the Euros for their away matches, I think, are they're all away matches. I don't know.
Away kit.
You know, Stephen has
got goodness,
football shirts.
Stephen is
he has football shirts on his shirt, so Arsenal kits, as far as I can tell.
Yes.
But anyway, Belgian team for some matches will be wearing a Tintin outfit, essentially. So it's a light blue t-shirt and brown shorts, which is, you know, like the clothes that Tintin wore with white socks. But it's you know, one of Belgium's most famous exports. But I think all teams should be required in the competition to do this.
Right.
I think, you know, basically the French should have to dress as Asterix, so you can have little sort of black shorts, red top, you know, little hat, maybe.
With horns?
With horns.
Mustache.
I think that would be good.
Not like
only
Obelix,
this is going to cause problems when they play against Scotland, who will be dressed as Dennis the Menace, because they will also be in red and black stripy tops and black shorts. But I think every team should have to dress as a national cartoon
Absolutely.
Character.
Absolutely.
This would make it more interesting for people who prefer cartoons to football.
And if you're under 10. What are your thoughts on this, Stephen? I'm quietly marvelling but slightly mind-boggled by Terry's suggestion that we all need to dress up as national cartoon characters. Well, rather the football team should.
I think it's brilliant.
I think
what the Belgians are doing, I when I first saw it, I thought, hang on, it's not the 1st of April, is it? No, it's not the 1st of April. It's not an April Fool's joke. I think it's really good. Usually the national team will play in the national colours of some sort. Often it's related to the flag of the country. But this takes it to a new dimension. And I wouldn't say that sky blue shirts and brown shorts is the best colour combination. I'm sure that Tyler would be horrified at the fashion aspect of it. But it's something very Belgian. And I think that's brilliant. I was trying to think, as I was going to say, Dennis the Menace, definitely for Scotland. The red and black hooped shirts would be great.
Who do you have for England?
I don't know.
Exactly.
That's the trouble. We haven't got it. You know, perhaps they have to dress as the Thompson twins out of Tintin, who were the English ones that run around.
Running around with
the bowler hat.
Bowler hats and the mat. That won't cause any problems with the England team at all.
But I think the other one I did think was that the American team should dress as Charlie Brown in Peanuts.
Or Snoopy. That would be brilliant.
Well, Snoopy, but Snoopy's kind of just white with a black nose.
Yeah, you can have
nose,
the yellow shirt with the zigzags.
But the zigzags that Charlie Brown wears.
I think we could try and beef this up a little. And actually, you know, if you are Tintin, you have to wear a blonde wig. If you are...
And have a dog on the pitch.
Dogs on the pitch are a little difficult under the
Not
laws
snowy.
Of the game.
Not me, Lou.
Even snowy.
Come on, we're underestimating, you know, what are we talking about?
And
here?
Hats and wigs are a little bit difficult when you come to head the ball. So, I'm sorry, I'm being very
seriously football. Especially if you've got the
Asterix
hat with a horn.
Yes,
Puncturing the ball with a horn. Yeah. I think you're underselling this, Stephen. I think we're adding an extra bit of spice.
I think we should get listeners to write in from their countries and suggest which cartoon characters, or it doesn't have to be cartoon characters, but something that goes beyond just representing the colours of the flag. I think this is a great idea.
Wonderful. Let's stay with sport, but problems. The Dutch. Tell us what's happening with the Dutch.
Yeah, this is an interesting story in The Guardian, which is a survey that has been done across Europe, where they have discovered that apparently even the sporty Dutch, in the headline in The Observer, are falling victim to what is being called chair use disorder. And this is apparently that the Dutch, who you tend to think of as, you know, in this article it's saying, a nation of healthy giants leaping on their bikes to cycle energetically. But this research has found that...
No stereotype there at all.
No. I mean, this is obviously a British newspaper, so I don't know how it's being reported in Holland. But they're saying that people are sitting too long, and we know that that is bad for you. But apparently, on average, a lot of people in the Netherlands spend more than... They sit on average in 2022 for 8.9 hours a day, particularly during working time and also during their commutes. And they're saying that although people might be exercising a lot in their free time, this amount of sedentary life is really bad for the nation's health. Looking at Romania seems to have the fewest people sitting for that.
Everyone's
for that
standing
long.
Up in Romania. They're all sitting down in the Netherlands. The problem here, Stephen, I believe, was because there's a lot of service industry jobs in the Netherlands. And also we're back to home working again. And also the idea that because the Netherlands are pretty brilliant when it comes to technology, then home delivery is a thing. So you don't actually need to leave the house to do anything. Your sofa is your best friend.
Yeah, but I think, again, as Terry said, it's a British newspaper. I think, although The Observer is not known for bashing foreigners too much, but I don't think the Dutch should be too worried. It's you know, it's a country where people do get out and about either on their bikes or because it's so flat they can walk a lot. Can I just throw in one other sporting story? Actually, just and this I'll bash Britain again. Well, England actually, I'll bash England.
England,
because here we are on the front page of today's Sunday Telegraph. Now, the Sunday Telegraph is renowned for being right wing. Brexit supporting, and the big picture, the big photograph on the front cover is of an England rugby player. England lost yesterday to France. Yes, it was close, as lots of the in the Six Nations this year, the rugby, a lot of the games have been close, but England lost. So why, you know, it has to be a flag of St. George waving right-wing newspaper that as England lose not to come anywhere close to winning the championship, they put a picture of an England player on the front. Excuse me, you know, find something else.
So, well, actually, the front page online at the moment, the joys of being able to look stuff up while you're on air. Award-winning fish and chip shop ordered to take down Union flag. I'm slightly feeling as if the wheels are coming off here. There's an owner left bemused when flag in southeast London deemed inappropriate for the area. There's a slightly more sinister thing going on here, isn't it? When you have dog whistle politics and you have... And we're looking at here, we have a man holding a... you know, it looks like a chip shop owner. He's got a Union flag hat. He's got his apron on and he's got a rather interesting mural outside his chip shop, which is of a fish holding... a flag next to a portion of chips. I mean, maybe the fish doesn't know what's just about to happen to it. But once you start to sort of make alliances about take the flag down, this, that and the other, it is in certain areas. And you do start to build on a much more sinister narrative, don't you, Terry?
Yes, because I haven't read the whole story, but it's probably one of those where if you go further down, you will discover that, you know, the fish and chip shop probably didn't have planning permission to put up a mural in the first place or something like that. There are always these kinds of issues that people then sort of think, well, how can I get my mural back? I'll go to the newspaper and I'll make a big fuss about it and, you know, presumably hopes that lots of angry Brits will turn up demanding fish and chips to support him. But yes, picking up on these things does, you know, obviously we've had a couple of weeks in the UK where there have been all sorts of arguments about British values, about extremism, about what that means and about, you know, what kind of country we want to be living in. And I think, yeah, there is, you know, yes, it's an easy story to do, but yeah, it also does, as you say, play into this idea of sort of culture wars.
We do, and when you do read a little bit further down, you see that the fish and chip shop owner is an immigrant from northern Cyprus. And the reason why he's got into trouble, not once but indeed twice for putting up the fish picture, is that it's a preservation area. And then you suddenly realise how complicated writing stories and the power of an image on the front page of a newspaper can start to play around with things.
And that, but it's typical then that it's the Sunday Telegraph, though, that because what has happened with, coming back to the flag, is that this Conservative government that we have at the moment, not for much longer, has made a big thing of flying the flag. It was never really a big deal in Britain, the Union flag being, of course, the flag which represents the England, Scotland and Ireland, and has a sort of nod to Wales, although there's no dragon on it. But it was never a big deal. And in recent years, particularly since that awful Brexit, the Conservative Party has made a big thing. You know, no Conservative politician will now be seen in a television interview or standing at a podium without having the Union flag behind him or her, because it's that they're trying to show that they are the party of the people, which the people don't believe they are, as will be seen in the election results later this year. But it's become a very divisive issue generally, actually, the flying of the flag in Britain.
And watching what's been happening in British politics in the last couple of days, the division seems to be massively from within the Conservative Party more than anything. I mean, for the last couple of days, there have been accusations that the right wing within the British Conservatives are trying to put another candidate, Penny Mordaunt, up as a stalking horse to try and undermine Rishi Sunak's chances of being elected. Do they even need to do that, one wonders?
I don't know what's going on at the moment. I think everyone needs to go and sort of just go and have a lie down in a darkened room, because the idea of replacing another Conservative leader, another Prime Minister, before the election. You know, we had Liz Truss, who lasted for about 6 weeks. We've got Rishi Sunak. All this idea that you would want to replace your leader before going into an election, which you would most likely lose, just does seem kind of strange to me. I mean, there's a sort of very weird conspiratorial mindset going on various issues in this country at the moment. But now Penny Mordaunt, who is supposedly, you know, being put up to lead this campaign, her team are now saying, well, no, I don't actually want to run a coup. This is my enemies who are plotting a coup, you know, pretending that I'm running a coup in order to discredit me. So it's getting absolutely feverish and strange.
And how do you feel about the way that all this news is being covered in the United Kingdom? I am finding myself moving further away from looking at domestic news because it seems to be a sort of a death spiral every single day. And one wonders where the editorial focus is in the UK at the minute.
Well, I think the trouble with, you know, where there's slightly a vacuum in terms of what's actually going on in terms of events and policy, and obviously there's hugely important things going on, not least in Ukraine, the Middle East, whatever, but sort of gossiping MPs fills a vacuum. And if you can get an MP to tell you something slightly crazy, well, you know, there's a plot, there's a conspiracy, that's going to get you into the paper. And, you know, that's journalists' jobs, to be fair. But you know, sometimes I think people need to take a bit of a step back and think, you know, is this really likely to happen? And I could be wrong, because I've often been wrong in the last few years about all of this.
I don't think anyone knows what right is anymore in terms of any kind of accuracy of prediction. I think we threw the runes out of the window a few years ago. But in terms of the relevance to the British audience, how much do you think, or the relevance to any kind of audience, how much do you think that a sort of an obsessive focus on the internal workings of a political party actually make any kind of emotional connection with the people who are, you know, living within a society and who may or may no longer be engaged with the media?
None whatsoever. And in fact, if you look at the what's often termed the popular press, so newspapers like The Sun, The Daily Mirror, The Daily Star, I think I'm right in saying all three of them this morning, certainly at least two out of three, are focused on a row connected to Strictly Come Dancing. And although we can sit here and be terribly pointy-headed and say, you know, well, that's not what's making the world go around, actually, it's what most people in this country are probably going to be talking about more than politics.
And in the 30 seconds that remains, Terry, this idea that people are not interested in politics, I wonder even if they're interested in Strictly Come Dancing, because the majority of people now are no longer connecting with the media in the way that they used to be, that everything has now become YouTube, TikTok and, you know, very, very sort of a pretty wild place there where people get the media.
Yes, I think so. I mean, you think how people aren't really reading print newspapers as much. They're not watching mainstream TV news bulletins as much. And people do, you know, particularly younger people, get a lot of their news online, and they know about things, but they know what an algorithm has shown them.
Terry Ciasny.
Long live radio is what I say.
Absolutely. And print. Terry Ciasny, Stephen DL, Navina Cotto, and of course, our editorial director, Tyler Brulé. The warmest of thanks to all my guests today. Thanks too to our producer and studio manager, Mariella Bevan. I'm Emma Nelson. Monocle on Sunday is back next week. I hope you can join me for that if you can. But until then, enjoy the rest of your weekend.